Radio. Radio. SaintBeat.com. Radio St. Pete, St. Petersburg, Clearwater, Tampa Bay, Florida, USA.
Radio StPete.com is live at the St. Pete Yacht Club. It is the Suncoast Tiger Bay Club Luncheon. The speaker, Jeff Weaver, the Bernie Sanders campaign manager in 2016. Let's go live to the podium. Here is Tiger Bay Club President Kelly Kirshner.
Including particularly the upcoming midterm elections, but Tiger Bay members, we will open the floor to you to ask questions. If you are not a member, you still have time to become a member, and that is important because only Tiger Bay members can ask questions of our featured speakers. If you'd like to ask a question today, please see Megan in the back to become a speaker. If you like something that you hear, please use hashtag Tiger Bay and post that to Facebook and Twitter. And special thanks to Joe Bordeaux and Radio St. Pete. Joe's a board member and treasurer, but Radio St. Pete is always with us, broadcasting Tiger Bay Lunches live and online as a podcast. At this point, let me remind you that we also have the Fang and Claw Award for the best question asked. Today we have three Tiger Bay board members ranking the questions. They include Tiger Bay Vice President Elise Minkoff, Tiger Bay Secretary Marilyn Miller, and Barclay Harless. The rules for the Fang and Claw question are quite simple. Only Tiger Bay members and Young Tigers may ask questions, so remember that, Young Tigers. 15 to 20 seconds to ask your question. No speeches. Make it to the point, please. If not, the bell will be rung. Marilyn Miller's on the bell today, and you will be in trouble. At this point, I would like to ask Tiger Bay board member Joanne Lentino to come forward to introduce today's speaker.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm very proud to introduce Mr. Jeff Weaver. Well, we can do this, right? Everybody hear me now? Okay. I'm very proud to introduce Mr. Jeff Weaver, who served as a campaign manager for the Bernie Sanders 2016 presidential campaign. Jeff helped to engineer one of the most remarkable set of political strategies in several decades. This innovative campaign challenged the dominant Democratic establishment and advanced a series of progressive issues and ideals that attracted new voters in unprecedented strength. In his presentation today, Jeff will discuss from his new book titled, How Bernie Won, Inside the Revolution That's Taking Back Our Country, and Where We Go From Here. The firsthand experience of developing an alternate political organization focused on policies and not personalities. Not to direct a negative campaign or big dollar fundraising, but relied instead on grassroots contributions that averaged $27. Jeff will share the dynamics of the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign that resulted in the stunning upset victory in the New Hampshire Democratic presidential primary election and victories in 22 other states with significant voter gains. In the process, Bernie Sanders went from little name recognition outside Vermont when he entered the presidential race to being one of the most respected and well-known political leaders in America. Jeff believes that Bernie's 2016 campaign changed the political debate in America. Issues like Medicare for All, free tuition at public colleges, and raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour have become mainstream conversation in the 2018 midterm election, possibly extending to the presidential race in 2020. Weaver served as Bernie's chief of staff in both the U.S. House and Senate. A Vermont native, he is a graduate of Vermont University and Georgetown University Law Center. Let's give a warm welcome to Mr. Jeff Weaver. Thank you so much.
All right, I've got a lot to do in 15 minutes, given that introduction. Listen, I want to thank everybody for having me here today. When this was planned, I don't think any of us knew what was going to be happening here in Florida. You folks down here have an incredible knack for putting yourself at the center of politics in the United States of America. And I don't know if you do it intentionally, but you seem to do it often enough that it must be intentional on some level. I have to tell you, as someone from the outside of Florida who follows national politics, the nomination of Andrew Gillum to be the next governor of Florida by the Democrats here really is the marquee race in many ways in the 2018 midterm cycle, because it clearly sets up a contest between the Trump view of America and Trump's Republican Party and the bold sort of progressive wing of the Democratic Party, a wing which I argue in my book has basically become the whole bird, in the person of Andrew Gillum. This is not going to be a campaign where you have to worry about where people stand on the issues. You're going to get a full-fledged presentation on both sides, and folks are going to have to make the choice of who they want to stand with. And I do want to speak just so the book, and I'm not going to get too much into the book because if you can read the book, you can have excerpts of the book, but I do want to say the book is obviously about the campaign and some great stories about Bernie and me on the road in the early days, and because I was his driver as a 20-year-old back in 1986 in an ill-fated campaign for governor. And, some of the difficulties we faced on the 2016 campaign, the strategies we employed, the momentum we gained from the generosity of people, you mentioned $27, which aggregated into $230 million. So, if you do that math, you can see the number of grassroots contributions we received. But I did want to, given this moment in Florida politics, talk just a second about something I do talk about in the book, which is the Democratic Party in America and where we are and what, there's been a lot of talk in the media, overblown in many cases, about this great division that exists in the Democratic Party. There is a debate going on inside the Democratic Party about what its core values are and how it's going to represent the people in this country. But in many ways, it's much more civil than at other periods in our history. And I argue in the book that the way forward for the Democratic Party is to return to its modern historical roots in the New Deal, led by FDR, who at that time was widely vilified and fought tooth and nail by many elements within the Democratic Party, which felt he was taking us in the wrong direction. And so the most important part of my book is a page and a half, which I'm going to read in a second, which I can read fairly quickly given the time constraints, which my editor told me not to put in the book. And you don't need to buy my book to buy it. You can go online. And it's FDR's 1944 State of the Union address at the final days of the Second World War and the final days of his final time of his life, in which he laid out the unfinished business of the New Deal, which formed the ideological foundation for the Democratic Party for most of its history, a time period in which it was the dominant party in America for decades, until it departed from that in the 1990s and has led to really unprecedented erosion of support of Democrats among its traditional working class base in this country, and increasingly among young people, including young people of color. I argue that by returning to those roots in people like Andrew Gillum or Bernie Sanders, Stacey Abrams in Georgia, Ben Jealous, and others, that we, in fact, can reconstitute that grand coalition that made the Democratic Party the dominant party in this country. And I read this to you first for the policy prescriptions that FDR talks about and where he believes we need to continue working, but also about the very prescient warning that FDR lays down in this State of the Union address that is particularly relevant at this particular time. And so I do want to read this because I do, again, my editors didn't want this in there. They said it's too blocky, people won't read it. I said, if they read anything, I hope they read this. So let me read it, and I apologize for reading it a little quickly. And this is FDR. It is our duty now to begin to lay the plans and determine the strategy for winning of a lasting peace and the establishment of an American standard of living higher than ever before known. We cannot be content, no matter how high that general standard of living may be, if some fraction of our people, whether it be one-third or one-fifth or one-tenth, is ill-fed, ill-clothed, ill-housed, and insecure. This republic had its beginnings and grew to its present strength under the protection of certain inalienable political rights. Among them, the right of free speech, free press, free worship, trial by jury, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures. These were our rights to life and liberty. As our nation has grown in size and stature, however, as our industrial economy expanded, these political rights proved inadequate to assure us equality in the pursuit of happiness. We have come to a clear realization of the fact that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence. Necessitous men are not free men. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictatorships are made. In our day, these economic truths have become accepted as self-evident. We have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station, race, or creed. Among these are the right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation, the right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living, the right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad, the right of every family to a decent home, the right to adequate medical care, and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health, the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment, the right to a good education. All of these rights spell security, and after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. America's own rightful place in the world depends in large part upon how fully these and similar rights have been carried into practice for our citizens. For unless there is security here at home, there cannot be lasting peace in the world. And this is the sort of prescient part of this, which I think we should all take to heart. One of the great American industrialists of our day, a man who has rendered yeoman service to his country in this crisis, recently emphasized the grave dangers of rightist reaction in this nation. All clear-thinking businessmen share his concern, indeed, if such reaction should develop. If history were to repeat itself and we were to return to the normalcy of the 1920s, then it is certain that even though we shall have conquered our enemies on the battlefields abroad, we shall have yielded to the spirit of fascism here at home. And that is what this election in Florida is about. That is what this fight at the national level is about. That is what these midterms are about. Are we going to have the courage and the vision to carry forward the unfinished business of the modern Democratic Party, or are we going to yield to the spirit of fascism here at home? And you see it in this president. I know this is a nonpartisan group, but I'm not nonpartisan. We see it in this president and his use of division, dividing people up by race, by religion, by gender, by sexual orientation, that sort of tearing apart at the cohesiveness of this nation in the interests of the very few at the top who have benefited tremendously from the tax policies, certainly, that he has pushed and other policies that he has tried to push. I think all Americans, and based on what I know, Republicans across the country, were appalled to see children torn from the arms of their mothers because they had committed the misdemeanor upon arrival at the border. None of us expect that we shall lose our children, in some cases permanently, or leave them in the hands of people who may sexually abuse them because we have committed a misdemeanor. That is not what happens in this country. That has happened in other countries. Our European allies faced the crisis that we face now at the beginning of the last century. They were not successful in dealing with it internally, and we and others had to go and sort of right the situation at the cost of tremendous human loss from the greatest generation of Americans. And when I look at the films, all of you watch the History Channel, there's more films on there about Hitler apparently than anything else, but there are films of the American sacrifice, American bodies lying in the beaches of France or in the Pacific, who had to go to war to defend against what is perhaps beginning to happen here in our very own country. So now is the time for people of goodwill, Democrats, independents, yes, even Republicans, to stand together and talk about how we need to move forward as a nation together, understanding that this nation will only be successful if we articulate a set of common principles and values and goals that we want to see every American be able to achieve, while at the same time recognizing that in each community there are different challenges to achieving those goals. And so I thank you all for your having me here. I'm happy to take questions on any topic, frankly, so, like ask me anything. But I want to thank you. I'm trying to cut Marilyn off. She's gonna. I like to always cut off the timekeeper. How am I doing, Marilyn? Thank you so much. And thank you all for having me. I want to thank especially Kelly, who folks may know was served on the Credentials Committee appointed by our campaign in 2016 at the Democratic National Convention. So I appreciate his work there. A little secret you don't know about. Sorry, Kelly. I added you right here. So anyway, I thank you, and it is a very serious time in America. I'm being a little bit flippant, but it is a serious time in this country, and you here in Florida have either the distinction and the great responsibility of helping to right this country. So it's a great responsibility, and but based on the people I've met in my few days here and other folks I've met in the past in Florida, I know that you are up to the task.
I assume that when the senator decided to run, that he was aware that he would divide the Democratic Party, thereby enhancing whoever the Republican candidate would be, and that's the way it worked out. I assume his calculation was it would be worthwhile to go down to defeat the Democratic candidate. Do you have any sense of guilt about the way things have worked out with the election? Oh, I already told you.
So I understand your question, Tom. Actually,
I assume the long work, the senator's thinking was, look, even if we lose, it's going to be worthwhile because we could talk about issues I want to talk about. And do you have any guilt?
So I have to say in my book, you know, I say at the beginning of the book, to the extent that I bear or we bear any responsibility for the election of Donald Trump is that we did not beat Hillary Clinton in 2016. That's the extent to which I bear guilt for anything. The truth of the matter is that we need primaries in this party. You just had a very hard-fought primary in Florida. Primaries are a very important way for the grassroots of the party to send a message to party leaders about what they want the direction of the party to be. And if you take that away, you take out a fundamental part of the communication that happens between grassroots people and people in the party leadership. So I've talked to Floridians all over. I was at a unity rally the other night in Duval County. Democrats in Florida are ready to come around their nominee for governor in this state. It's very gratifying to see. In 2016, I spent a lot of time on television. I was advocating for the election of Secretary Clinton in the fall. I thought she was to say she was far superior to Donald Trump is the understatement of the century. Bernie Sanders visited state after state in this country, including many states that Hillary Clinton chose not to visit, which in hindsight was a mistake. So do I bear some responsibility for weakening Secretary Clinton? No. The Democratic primary process, when done about issues, is a way to strengthen candidates. A lot of issues get vetted out in primaries, which are then taken off the table in the general election. In fact, I have heard criticism from some people that we in fact, were not hard enough on some of the non-policy issues because then they were left on the table for the Republicans to go after in the general election when they could have been dealt with in the primary process. But that's not the kind of campaign that Senator Sanders wanted to run. He wanted to run on a set of issues, talk about how we uplift this country, how we transform the Democratic Party, and he was not willing to engage in kind of the negative tear down of politics that too many do these days. So I guess I reject the sort of assumptions underlying your question that somehow the primary process damaged Secretary Clinton in some way. To the extent that I talked to political professionals, it was because we were too kind.
Bob Sopransky, my question is, if we implement all the policies and issues that you are recommending that we follow, won't we eventually end up looking like North Korea, Venezuela, and Cuba? Because where is the freedom? Where is economic advance? Where can people make a living? Why are those people fleeing here? How come over 2.5 million people want to get to the United States and Venezuela? How come we have all the Cubans here, and also we have some North Koreans too? So I think your policies are thumbs down.
Well, I thank you for the question. That's a talking point I hear often. I hope nobody is confused about whether or not I'm up here advocating for authoritarianism, because it's exactly the opposite of what I'm advocating for. In fact, to the extent that we see authoritarian tendencies in this country, they are certainly within the Trump movement. The president himself is an authoritarian personality. He rules in that way. He has basically his administration, other than the tax bill, has been unsuccessful in even rallying his own party in Congress to pass his agenda. So, and thankfully, because he has not been able to have control over his own party, because, in fact, many of them, as we're reading in the papers now, are, in fact, actively working to prevent the excesses that he is trying to perpetuate on the country. When we elect a Democrat in 2020, all of those things he has signed, all those declarations and executive orders can all be taken out into the Rose Garden and put into a big bonfire, and that will be a great day for this country.
Yes, Peter Goldenbaum.
Hi, Peter.
Shortly before,
it's tough under the clock.
Shortly before the Democratic primary, Bernie Sanders gave his approval for Andrew Gillum. And Andrew Gillum turned out to be an incredibly surprise victor. Could you tell us what went on behind the scenes between Bernie Sanders and Andrew Gillum to bring the two of them together?
Well, I can't tell you everything that goes on behind the scenes, at least not now. Maybe that's in the next book. But I will say this, that Andrew Gillum's race caught the senator's attention very early. I think Andrew Gillum is known, frankly, nationally, even before he has this, now has this big platform as the Democratic nominee here, as an inspiring leader who unabashedly stood with working-class people from every zip code. And so in my world, he was a known person. The type of campaign he ran here in Florida was phenomenal. It was a grassroots campaign. He was obviously heavily outspent, but he did have sufficient resources. Often progressive candidates don't have the sort of baseline resources you need. He was able to accumulate those. He put together the kind of coalition that is going to be critical going forward for the Democratic Party to win. There's so many young people who have given up on the Democratic Party and politics in general, and people like Andrew Gillum are bringing them back in. That was one of the things that Bernie Sanders did, one of the things that Barack Obama did. You know, Barack Obama won Indiana in 2008, first time a Democrat had won Indiana in a gazillion years, and the only age group that he won in Indiana was 18 to 35, I believe it is, right? So this outpouring of young people voting is a created tremendous energy in the party, created tremendous energy for Andrew Gillum, and is in Democratic parties, county parties, all over this country where they have been open to new people coming in, they provided tremendous new energy there as well. So Andrew Gillum was on everybody's radar screen. He was obviously in the polls lagging, but I think Senator Sanders felt at the end of the day that a candidate of his vision and his ability to really galvanize this type of coalition that I'm talking about outweighed any concerns about his quote-unquote viability. And so Bernie came down and had two events with him. And he also endorsed a number of down-ballot candidates, three of which had primaries on the same day, and they all won as well.
Tiffany Bikas. Similar to what was asked earlier, but the failure of Bernie supporters to turn into Clinton supporters probably did lose the election. What can we learn from that experience? What could have been done differently to change that outcome, and how do we avoid that happening here with our election?
Yeah, so a couple of points on that, one of which is a factual point, which doesn't really answer your question, but is one of these political slides, which is, the research shows that a higher percentage of Clinton supporters in 2008 supported McCain, defected to McCain than Bernie supporters did defected to Trump. So that's sort of the research has borne that out. Look, primaries are hard-fought things. The truth is politicians don't own anybody's vote. Voters make a decision at each election who they're going to support at each step. I try not to Monday morning quarterback the Clinton folks. I got to know many of the top leaders and, have good professional relationships with a lot of the top leaders in Hillary Clinton's campaign. I have a lot of personal respect for the secretary herself. So I don't want to Monday morning quarterback them. I think they made some critical errors, all that being said, some critical errors in reaching out to the Bernie coalition that had come together in the primaries that could could have turned out differently. Look, at the end of the day, the problem was that candidates run in a historical moment. And I think that at another time, Hillary Clinton would have easily been elected, nominated, and elected. But the country was in a certain place in terms of its mood and what have you, and Hillary Clinton was not the candidate at that time to represent that feeling among grassroots America. And it was in a diverse set of communities where the falloff was. Young voters of color largely did not turn out in the numbers that anybody anticipated. I mean, I have there's a lot of research, and I have plenty of anecdotal evidence from people who had been Bernie people working on the Hillary campaign, campaigning in communities of color where, you know, older households were all in for Hillary, and young people were like, I'm just not voting because I don't feel that she's a vehicle for change. And people were in a change mood at that time. And you can see that, you know, Trump changed for the worse, Bernie changed for the better, my personal opinion. But people wanted something different than what had been going on.
What is your opinion on having a two candidates in the last primary running for governor were self-funded, and the other candidates appeared not to be self-funded, especially Andrew Gillum? It was as surprising, very surprising, at the end of the primary where Andrew Gillum went over the line, and he was the candidate of record for the next election we have in November. What is your opinion on having self-funded candidates on the Democratic ticket that are pushing really hard to try to get everybody's attention, and actually it really backfired on them?
Yeah, so you know, we did run this campaign, this $27 contribution campaign, and did raise a lot of money at it. You know, the problem with money in politics are there are many. Self-funding is one of them. Unfortunately, you know, the courts have said that you can self-fund. But I do think, you know, the problem is that when you run and you self-fund, you know, fundraising is in part a way of gauging support, right? There's all these measures of support a candidate, feedback sort of candidates get when they're running, right? And one of them is donations, and you can, you know, it's also a signal for voters. Who's giving and why are they giving? And when you're running a grassroots campaign that's funded with small dollar contributions, that sends a certain signal to voters, right? And you're getting a certain signal back from voters. So I do think that self-funding is a negative thing. I mean, I understand why people do it. Fundraising is terrible. No one likes to do fundraising. Candidates don't like to do fundraising. And if you can't, you know, Bernie was not a candidate who had to make fundraising phone calls like, hey, can you give me $1,000? You know, the congressional candidates on both parties, this is not Democrat, Republican, you know, spend hours and hours and hours on phone calls with lists of people asking for $500 or $1,000. And it's emotionally and psychologically extremely draining. And Bernie never had to do that. We just pushed a button on a computer and people gave us money. So it was very liberating for him, because then he could focus on campaigning. And, you know, I talked to my friends in the Clinton campaign, who I referenced earlier. You know, they had an incredible fundraising schedule personally, not just the secretary, but like Robbie Mook, the campaign manager, and John Podesta and Uma Abedin. All these people, they had their own personal fundraising schedules. They were going to fundraising events, right, at a time when they're trying to run and win a campaign. So, you know, what we need to do eventually, look, this is not a point that's, you know, it is a point of some controversy, but look, we need to move toward a public funding system in campaigns so that people run and then they owe their election to voters and not donors.
Ray, I have a question about the age dilemma that the Democratic Party is facing. I have a lot of friends who are speculating about who would be the best standard bearer in 2020, and I think a lot of them are great admirers of Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, but feel that their advanced age would be a liability, and that a lot of other people are suggesting we need some sort of, you know, young, fresh face. I wonder what you think about that. Are Biden and Bernie viable candidates? Should we look to them?
Well, certainly the polling shows they're viable candidates. Look, you know, this is obviously an issue that was raised in 2016 as well, right? Senator Sanders is a little bit older than some of the other candidates who are running. To me, the issue is not about the person's age, but about the person's ideas. So they have fresh ideas. So they have new ideas. They're going to take us in a new direction that's going to allow us to rebuild this country and to bring the country together. That's what's important as opposed to the chronological age. Look, I'm on a, like on a personal level in terms of Bernie Sanders, incredible human stamina. I don't know what to tell you other than, you know, in 2016, we have these, you have reporters that follow you around in a little bus, embedded reporters, and they're all like in their 20s, and it's usually their first gig, and we were not a race that people thought was going to be successful, so, you know, more senior reporters jumped, you know, went to Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush or other people they thought were going to be more likely to win. And they all, when we started off, had this, you know, these stories half written about how Bernie had a light schedule and wasn't going to be able to keep up and needed a nap and all this stuff. And I got to tell you, after the first week, they threw them all in the trash. You know, the second day, one of them came up to me and said, When are we having lunch? There's no lunch on the schedule. I said, Bernie doesn't eat lunch. He works through lunch. So if you want lunch, you better bring it. I mean, so the guy has, I don't know if it's good genes, I don't know what it is, force of will, I don't know what it is. But incredible stamina and vigor, and frankly, probably more so than most other candidates half his age. I mean...
Or Latimer Lakewood High School. As time changes, like internet and social media becomes a bigger factor into our culture. So my question is, how do you feel as if internet culture affects politics?
Yeah, so it's been, like everything, it's a great source of good and it's a great source of problems, right? So the ability of the internet to connect people together who feel the same way, you know, often politics or not, anything else, people feel isolated. And so you can find sort of kindred souls online. It's a great way to reach out to people and tell them about events and about things that are happening. So in that way, I think the internet is great. On the other hand, there's really a very ugly side of social media, Twitter being the primary, you know, housing of this. There's a tremendous amount of disinformation, outright lies. I was just listening to an NPR show where the host was asking the head of Twitter why it is that so many people who use Twitter describe it as a cesspool. It is manipulated. The conversation on Twitter is largely artificial. There's a tremendous amount of funded stuff that's going on Twitter that you don't even know is funded. You know, there's recently revealed, there's a thing which I call neoliberal Twitter, which is a sort of organized and well-financed campaign. I haven't figured out who's financing it yet, but we'll figure it out. That's sort of gone after Senator Sanders since the day after the general election. And one of the chief perpetrators of this, you know, recently inadvertently disclosed that she has 60 Twitter accounts. And she has so many Twitter accounts that she can trend her own things by liking and, you know, retweeting and all this. So that's the danger on, and it's particularly acute on Twitter because it's anonymous, right? Unlike Facebook. Facebook is bad enough, but Twitter is anonymous. And so there's a real, you really have to filter what you see on social media in terms of its veracity.
Morgenstein. Bernie Sanders has people that follow him, and they would follow him to the end of the world. But now that Gillum is in, and now that he has picked somebody as his lieutenant, do you think Bernie should maybe step back for the people who didn't feel that maybe he would be the one?
Well, look, you know, I think Bernie Sanders will try to help Andrew Gillum in any way that Andrew Gillum thinks is appropriate for Bernie to do. And so we will certainly follow Andrew Gillum's lead on that. If Andrew Gillum wants Bernie to come back, I'm certain he would come back. If he thinks it's better he not come back, I think he would not come back. We try to be helpful to candidates. Bernie, having run a lot of campaigns himself, really respects the sort of on-the-ground knowledge that candidates have. So the truth of the matter is, for Andrew Gillum to win, he is going to have to keep that coalition he created together. He is obviously going to have to bring other people in who supported other candidates. I suspect, given that in reality, party identification is the leading indicator of who you'll vote for in a general election. If you're a registered Democrat, registered Democrats overwhelmingly support the Democratic candidate in the general election. Republicans overwhelmingly support the Republican candidate. That's just a fact. The question is about these other folks, the MPAs in Florida. Because you have a closed primary system, we don't really have a read on MPAs. You know, the closed primary system in Florida is rather anomalous in the U.S. It's one of a number of few states that have closed primaries. In states that have open primaries, you have some sense of how independents feel because they participated in the primaries. But I have to tell you, you know, a lot of people are tied to the old notion that there's Democrats on the left, all these moderate independents in the middle, and conservatives in the Republican Party. And that model, that was certainly the model a lot of people had in 2016. And that's just not a valid model anymore for where people are at. Overwhelmingly, young people are registering as independents. Over 50% of young people are registering as independents. And so there is a large block of independents who are not here. They're over here on this side of the Democratic Party. And when you do what people normally do, which is sort of scoot to the middle in the general election, these people, they don't go to the Republicans, they just go away. And if that happens, Andrew Gillum will have a hard time winning.
Hi, I'm Rich Edmonds. This is a related question to Ray Arsenault's, but I think a little different. When and if Senator Sanders steps aside, who could succeed him in leading this movement? And I'd love some names or at least some qualifications.
Well, that's all. I was on CBS News the other night, and they were like, tell us, go down the list of everybody who's talked about as president, and give us their strengths and weaknesses. I said, oh, you're trying to make me very popular in this room. But I don't know if I'm prepared to answer that question. Look, this movement is growing, sweeping the country, and the truth of the matter is that leaders will emerge, frankly, through the normal process we have. Andrew Gillum has obviously emerged not only as a leader in Florida, but across the country. And I think you're seeing that in state after state, that people are running for office and they are emerging as leaders. And so, you know, I am a great believer. You know, the Democratic Party just got rid of superdelegates last weekend after some long and hard work by some of us to put the choice of the nominee back in the hands of the rank and file. And I really believe, you know, this is apropos of the conversation about primaries. You know, that's another way that example of why we need to have primaries, because leaders are picked in primaries. And sometimes candidates who don't win primaries end up being leaders as well. And so I would leave it in the hands of the voters. The voters will tell us who those leaders should be, who inspires them, who they want to carry the standard.
Tony Wynn, Senior, Lakewood High School. It feels as if one of the more silenced voices in the community in all of America are those who are not old enough to vote. Why isn't there more being done to help younger people get into politics and save the heritage for the future?
Okay, well, I agree with that 100%. And we, you know, our campaign, you know, did a lot to try to reach out to young people, and I think with some success. You know, Bernie Sanders got more millennial votes in 2016 than either Hillary or Trump combined. And, you know, I'll tell you from a personal level, I work very hard in a lot of places. A lot of places, 17-year-olds can vote in primaries if they're going to be 18 by the general election. And we worked very hard to reach out to high school seniors in those states, Iowa being one of them. Actually, I talk in my book about this program I ran sort of under the radar quietly to reach out to high school seniors throughout Iowa who were eligible to vote but who were very difficult to contact because they're minors. And so the normal ways you would contact people aren't really available to you. But thanks to the fact that marketing companies have information, exhaustive information about every one of us, details you would be shocked to know about that they have, we were able to rent lists of high school seniors. My staff said that was impossible because they're minors. I said, I guarantee it, that my class rings, they apply to colleges, they take the SAT or the ACT, you know, they're buying caps and gowns. I said, somebody has a list of high school seniors in Iowa. And you know what? They did. And we reached out to them, and we ran a specific program around them. We also fought in Ohio, where they also allow 17-year-olds to vote in the primary if they're going to be 18. The Republican Secretary of State there was trying to stop that from happening, and we actually had to go to court to defeat their efforts to disenfranchise these young people. But look, young people are the future of the country and the party, frankly. And this is why I often talk about closed primaries, because we're locking young people out of the Democratic Party because so many of them are registering MPA. And that's really bad for the future of this party.
My name is Darby Jones. Quick question. I'm very curious what your thoughts are about the anonymous op-ed article.
Well, as somebody who worked on, you know, Capitol Hill, I was Bernie's chief of staff in the Senate and in the House. Unprecedented is, I guess, the word I would say. I mean, it is unlike anything you have ever seen, but it shows you to the extent to which this president has alienated even people in his own party who understand that what he is doing or trying to do is so destructive to the country. I mean, I was a little breathless personally because it's just not something that's done. You know, even when people who work for a political figure have a disagreement with her or with him, you know, usually they quit or they go away or they do something else, they work for somebody else. But this was just, I mean, just unprecedented and shows you the depths of the problems there.
Arlen Briley, thank you for coming here today.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask about Medicare for All.
Sure.
Major platform point. And my first reaction is, it's never going to happen, so why do we talk about it? But, of course, what I'd really like to hear is, how could Bernie Sanders make it happen? And I just want to point out that the state of Vermont announced after the Affordable Care Act that they were going to apply for waivers so that they could have a single-payer system. They put the best people together in Vermont to come up with how this could be done, and but they ultimately scrapped the idea because they couldn't, the finances just wouldn't work out. It couldn't be done, basically, even at a state level. So it seems to me it's going to be a very tough pull lift. And how are we going to overcome the resistance from people who will rightfully insist, if I have the money to buy more, better services from a hospital or doctor I choose, I want to have that freedom.
Yeah, so that's a multi-layered question. I'll try to answer it in the limited time I have here. The Vermont thing I actually talk about in the book. Governor Shumlin was the Democratic governor of Vermont, was a single-payer advocate. I don't usually throw people under the bus in books. He certainly got thrown under the bus in my book. Bernie dragged him across the finish line. He was wildly unpopular in Vermont. Bernie dragged him across the finish line in an election that he should have lost. And then he turned around and abandoned single payer, not because it wasn't going to work, but because he didn't have the political capital or the political will to get it done. So that's my view on former Governor Shumlin. In terms of single payer, look, single payer is growing in strength in this country. There was a recent poll that showed 80% of Democrats and 52% of Republicans now support single payer. It just makes sense for people. And anybody who knows about how insurance works understands that the larger the pool, unless you're self-selecting a healthier and healthier pool, which is a problem, you spread the costs around more. Every one of our Western industrial allies does something different than we do. They have lower cost per capita, they have universal coverage, and they have better health outcomes, right? Better health outcomes. We do very poorly. And so we have got to do something different. Single payer makes the most sense. A tremendous amount of bureaucracy and waste in the way we do it under the fiction of choice in this country. You know, a lot of people in this room probably have insurance, can't find a doctor to take that insurance. They got high copays, high deductibles, high premiums. The ripoff on prescription drugs is like incredible in this country. I remember early on Bernie took, when he was in the Congress, took a busload of women to Canada because I grew up 60 miles south of Montreal, Quebec, who had breast cancer, who were taking a very expensive drug called tamoxifen, and the same drug, same packaging, sold in Canada, 10% of the price that they were paying in Vermont. So the amount of cost that could be wrung out is good for consumers, it's good for businesses, it's putting us at a competitive disadvantage vis-a-vis our Western allies, and we have got to move in another direction where people have health insurance as a right, people have access to medical care, and we're not getting ripped off.
Jim Gillespie, Trump sits now on a deficit of $21 trillion, part of which he created. Would you tell us, looking at the three co-equal branches of the federal government, what measures would you take to raise the funds necessary to give the economic, social, and financial security to all Americans on at least above substantive basis? What measures would you enact? Because you opened by saying you were focused on policies, not personality. You've got a lot of questions about personality.
Well, the first policy thing that has to be done is to undo the Republican tax cut bill that was passed in this last Congress. It is a giveaway to large corporations. We've seen the result of it has been stock buybacks and executive bonuses and not really investment in the economy. You know, we have a real problem in this economy in that you have the macro numbers in our economy are really great. If you look at the macro numbers, low unemployment, stock market is booming. But if you look at people's households, it's a very different experience. Wages are basically stagnant and have been stagnant. And until you can increase the buying power of working class Americans, our economy is two-thirds driven by consumer consumption. So you have got to raise the minimum wage to a living wage in this country. If you raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, you'd give 40% of Americans a raise, and they would have money. I got to tell you, I'm not just a politician or a political strategist or whatever I am, but I also own a small business. I own a comic book store. I have 7 employees in the city of Falls Church, Virginia. I pay the taxes. I pay the employees. All my employees who work full-time make $15 an hour. Everybody who works part-time makes $12 an hour. And I got to tell you, my life would be so much better if all of my customers made $15 an hour, because comic books are not the first thing you buy when you get your paycheck. You got to pay the light bill, the food bill, the rent, and the amount that's left over for discretionary income is very little. And I got to tell you, a lot of micro enterprises, flower stores and bookstores and small retail and small restaurants, would be doing so much better. I got 7 employees, but I have hundreds of customers, and I wish they all had a bunch more discretionary income. And how we do that is raising the minimum wage. So that's a concrete policy we need to do. We need to do it quickly.
I'm going to take the privilege of the last question. Kelly Kirshner, and maybe go back to Tom's first question on the impact of the supporters, and it also relates to our Young Tigers question about the use of the internet. Right before the Democratic National Convention, there was an email dump that we've subsequently learned was probably done by Russian intelligence forces that led to a lot of division that then goes immediately into the general election. I was wondering if you could comment on what you've learned since then about the participation of foreign actors in the election, what impact you felt that that had, and were we manipulated as American citizens in perhaps acting and suppressing the vote and not participating during the general election?
Sure. Look, it is very clear that I think the evidence is overwhelming that the agents of the Russian government interfered not only in the election, but more broadly in the sort of social relations of our country. They posed as Black Lives Matter people at some points. They infiltrated other movements because they're trying to create discord in this country, and they're trying to create the kind of division in which somebody like Trump, frankly, thrives. Now, we have got to build a movement, and that's, I talk about Andrew Gelman, Bernie Sanders, other people. We have got to create a movement that is strong enough to withstand that. At the same time, we take all of the measures that one can take to keep that kind of interference from happening again. So it is a very serious problem. As somebody who talks to people who are thinking about running in 2020, I think all of them are aware of the dangers that are posed by it. But, so one of the remedies is to take every action possible. Obviously, if there were Americans who were involved in illegal activity in coordination with the Russians, they should be punished, whoever they are. And it shouldn't stop at how high you are or how low you are. In addition to that, we need to build the kind of movement that has the confidence of working class people in this country from every zip code so that we can go forward. And people will, I think if they're committed enough, will be able to withstand some of that negative propaganda.
Thank you very much. If you want to have any concluding remarks, not about Russians.
Yeah, no. Listen, I want to thank you all again for coming out. I appreciate all the questions. I really do, all the questions. Because this is the kind of discussion we need to have in this country. And, I am always amazed. One of the things that happens, one of the other effects of the internet, which is not positive, is that all of us can choose to live in a circle of friends and acquaintances who are all just like us. And so there's too little opportunity for us to have conversations with people who hold different points of view. And I think that that's a part of our civic culture, which is being lost, and it's unfortunate. So I do appreciate you having me here, and I do appreciate all the questions, whether they were friendly, as we say in the business, or not so friendly. But thank you so much.
Jeff, you might not be familiar with it, but we've got the coffee cup for you, just like Meet the Press, that you'll be able to now hopefully take on the next time you're on CBS News or NBC News. We'll expect you to use your Tiger Bay mug. And for the best question asked at a Tiger Bay luncheon, we award a plush tiger that actually roars. And so this is a highly sought-after prize. There's less tigers awarded every year than we have had presidents of this great country. So this one will be number 9 of this year as opposed to number 45. And we had a lot of really incredibly good questions, and it looks like there's a lot of dissent on who the best question was, but it looks like the choice that the individual that keeps coming up is actually Laura Latimer, our student from Lakewood High School, and we are really glad you attended. Laura and Jeff, if you could come up, and we're going to get a picture of you here in the at the Tiger Bay. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, this is
while they get together and take this shot. I just want to thank you all for coming again. Please do remember October 11th, 6:30 p.m., USF St. Pete, will be the dinner celebrating Tiger Bay's 40th anniversary and continuing these great conversations like the one we had today. Thank you all very much.
You've been listening to live coverage of today's Suncoast Tiger Bay Club Luncheon from the Yacht Club in St. Petersburg. Our speaker was Jeff Weaver, the national campaign manager for Bernie Sanders in the 2016 presidential election. Thank you for listening. This is Joe Bordeaux now returning you to our studio.
Radio St. Pete.